Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role should the Black church play in helping women overcome the multi-generational trials of poverty? While many Black Christian women find spiritual guidance and a sense of hope in their faith communities, my guest today would argue the church can also be a catalyst for social and economic justice in a country that continues to stigmatize many poor women as solely responsible for the hardships in their lives. Carrie Day is Assistant Professor of Theological and Social Ethics and Director of Black Church Studies at Bright Divinity School. Her new book is called Unfinished Business, Black Women, the Black Church, and the Struggle to Thrive in America. She'll be speaking at the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's MLK Symposium on the role of the African-American church in the civil rights movement on Monday, January 21st at Dallas City Performance Hall. And we're so glad she could make time for us today. Carrie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you write that the aim of this book is to develop the concept of thriving in America. What does that mean?
Absolutely. Thriving, as I talk about it in the book, is borrowed upon a concept that specifically comes from a feminist theorist by the name of Selah Benabib, and actually another one called Nancy Fraser. And so I borrowed this concept, and essentially thriving is the idea of each individual being able to participate on par with their peers. And so part of the question in general that I'm sure we're going to talk about related to poverty is actually what are the conditions under which we can ameliorate and end poverty. And part of my solution is, in order to do that, we have to begin to talk about how to develop a concept and a practical solution that is oriented towards thriving, which then is developing the cultural as well as the economic resources that allows poor peers to participate with their non-poor peers. So again, it's just not the culture, which I'm sure we'll get into, mm-hmm. which is what does it mean as individuals to participate in hard work? What it means as individuals to be a part of communities where they can flourish? But also the economic resources. What are the ways in which institutions and the ways in which structures sometimes impede individuals from not having access to certain resources that they need in order to participate on par with other non-poor peers?
Well, I was really interested in this because you write that poor Black women experience a different kind of racial oppression even than their middle class and upper class sisters within the same church congregation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting about this entire discussion on economic difference, class difference is what I call it in the book, is that there is this assumption moving into the 21st century that I think is employed not only by sort of leaders broadly within non-African-American communities, but also Black leaders, that race is still seen fundamentally as determinant of all African-Americans' life chances, mm-hmm. including cultural and economic life chances. And part of what I attempt to foreground in the book is that sort of moving into the 21st century, I talk about the history of the shifts in American political economy, the shift from the manufacturing industry primarily beginning in the 1970s to a post-industrial political economy in which it left behind really an entire group of folks that goes across racial categories to include poor rural whites, poor Latinos, Latinos and poor Blacks. So that when we begin talking about sort of the economic experiences of poor Blacks, that it becomes distinctly different given this history, particularly in urban areas for poor Blacks, than your middle class to upper class African Americans. And one thing that a lot of research has shown, such as, for example, Black sociologist William Julius Wilson in his book, The Truly Disadvantaged, is that these economic life chances also structure the cultural experiences of people, hence the cultural experiences of poor Blacks, who a lot of times experience a dearth of employment opportunities, educational opportunities, and economic opportunities. And of course, years, that really resonates with me growing up in a middle-class African-American environment where my dad was a trained economist, my mother was a social worker, that it's sort of on point, this discussion about the ways in which the cultural experiences and the middle-class sensibilities that I carry are distinctly different in a lot of ways than those who are in lower income brackets or who find themselves locked in underclass populations. And so with this book, it is to shine light on the differentiation economically and culturally within the Black community and to ask, how is the Black community, how are Black leaders going to grapple with this in a serious and substantive manner?
So Carrie, when you talk about people being locked in poverty, this is something that people are finally starting to understand and to study and to find a way out of. But we defined thriving earlier. You define poverty as not only a lack of income, but a lack of assets. And that lack of assets, the lack of, say, middle-class mom and dad, middle-class grandparents, is the reason that a lot of people, particularly poor Blacks who've been able to move up into the middle class, they lack resiliency if there is a single setback.
Yeah. And I think a part of the discussion on, oh gosh, this category of being locked in something economically, I just want to note here that this causes this discourse on when we start talking about being locked in intergenerational cycles of deprivation and poverty, it does cause a lot of angst and anxiety among people in America because sort of our general narrative as a country is this land of economic and political opportunity, the land of liberty. So that sort of within the market narrative of the American dream, even that I talk about in the book, the idea that when you do come to this country or if you are born in this country, that you can sort of lift oneself up out of poverty. And there's something I would argue is absolutely partially true about that. Mm-hmm. So I want to be clear before I go
into. I love that phrase, absolutely partially true.
Right. Yeah. Isn't that interesting? And that's the contradiction and the irony. That's mm-hmm. why I want to stick with that. So the absolutely, partially is true, that there's tremendous experience in terms of opportunity, especially when you begin to travel the world. Mm-hmm. But part of the contradiction, part of the irony of the American experience here, particularly, I would say, as we're going to talk about, Martin Luther King Day is coming up for African Americans who have had to face down the contradiction and the irony, right, of this narrative of the American dream, of the narrative of the land of opportunity, but yet a history that contradicts that, that belies that, is also this idea that there are ways in which systemic and structural issues, economic issues, continue to impede large groups of people, such as poor Black women. For example, the living wage. Now, that's not a uniquely African-American female issue, mm-hmm. but certainly it affects African-American women, primarily when we get into economic inequity on the wage where women are still making 80 cents on the dollar to a man that makes a dollar doing the same sort of work. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that women are the primary caretakers of children, period, not only in this country, but globally.
And more and more they're the primary breadwinners as well.
Absolutely. And the primary, and increasingly, right, that we're seeing mm-hmm. are the primary breadwinners. And so there's a way in which it is really important not to dismiss or ignore, which I would argue has been the case within sort of the larger national poverty discussion, on wanting to talk about sort of the personal aspect of why people are impoverished. It's their moral failure, right? It's mm-hmm. because they're personally irresponsible, to the exclusion of detailing that there are actual institutional and structural issues, such as I just named, the living wage, the absence, which, I mean, this is a whole nother sort of conversation that Obama has tried to remedy with the passing of the Health Care Legislation Act, as well as child care, issues with child care, that keeps these sort of intergenerational cycles of deprivation going. So it's really saying, how do we begin to speak honestly and authentically about this tension in America related to poverty?
And hanging on, Carrie, I guess, to this dream that we have, which is, as you said, absolutely partially true, that theoretically in this country you have the opportunity to sort of pull yourself up, and if you work hard enough, to thrive. It really does pat on the back people who have had economic success. But conversely, it also assumes that anyone who struggles must be doing something wrong, if not in terms of morally wrong, at least doing something wrong with regard to, say, work ethic.
You're absolutely right. Part of the problem with that particular explanation, a couple of things, is sort of, as I've stated before, it ignores those sort of institutional impediments that exacerbate poverty. But then secondly, it doesn't really deal honestly with the ways in which there are certain people, and I love to use a social ethicist by the name of Jamie Kavanaugh, his language, that there are ways in which certain people are born with what he calls initial endowments. Mm-hmm. This idea that, and I would be one of those people, mm-hmm. born with initial endowments. And what is meant by that is, you know, when I was born into a family that was middle class, that my father, my mother made a pretty good income. I grew up and went to private school my whole life. I was afforded many opportunities upon which to succeed. But these initial endowments helped to, in a lot of ways, cultivate my own human and educational potentiality, which allowed me to do other things. And that part of what Kavanaugh is getting at that I agree with is that when you talk about simply the personal and moral failures of people, it really doesn't get at the ways in which in America there are individuals and groups that have sort of initial endowments that do in a lot of ways determine what they're actually able to do and be. Now, certainly you do have, of course, individuals that work their way up, that come out of extreme chronic poverty and deprivation. But what I would like to argue is a couple of things. The first is we find that sort of, broadly speaking, a lot of times it tends to be the exception rather than the rule. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what does it mean to say, well, you know, Condoleezza Rice did it, right? So then
if she can do it, why can't everybody do it?
Why can't everyone do it? I think sort of bypasses and negates this larger, as I talked about, social and structural issue related to real economic impediments.
So do you think that the church has dropped the ball here? Because as you mentioned in the book, first of all, we will say you make the point in the book that the black church is not monolithic and never has been. And we can maybe talk a little bit more about that and how much we can generalize here. But the church remains a source of spiritual support for women of all income levels, a source of community, a source of hope. But you feel like hope is where sometimes it stops.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of in chapter one, I really try to make this particular argument that the black church, I think, has the internal moral resources to play a part in the way that they once did. And we'll talk about what does that mean. I mean, because let me be clear here, very clear, that at the height of the civil rights movement, you know, I think it was around 13% of African-American churches were actually in solidarity with King. So the first thing, sort of myth that needs to be dispelled, is somehow that the black church was behind persons like King or Ella Baker in general, that it was always sort of the courageous minority, right? Even within the black church, mm-hmm. it was only the few minority black churches that actually stood up prophetically and challenged the status quo. But then also with the black church, part of the other issue that I try to raise is that in order for the black church to really be effective in dealing with the poor within its ranks, is to be honest about the historical contradictions that have plagued the black church, that the black church hasn't always been kind to poor members within its own community. I mean, this is a history of debates that goes all the way back to thinkers like W.E.B. Du Bois that I talk about in the book, where, you know, in the 20th century, the 19th century rather, there was still conversation on exactly how politics was to interact with religion within the black church. And one thing that many of those leaders had already decided is that the black black church was the one institution governed by African Americans that needed to be reformed because, in a lot of ways, of some of the corruption, because of the lack of accountability among, at that time, black male ministers. And as I talk about in the text, which is what you bring up, is this idea that sometimes the absence of hope is not quite present because of the way African American women are treated within these spaces, that there's sexism and patriarchy and the like.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Carrie Day. Her new book is Unfinished Business. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Carrie Day, who is Assistant Professor of Theological and Social Ethics and Director of Black Church Studies at Bright Divinity School. Her new book is called Unfinished Business, Black Women, the Black Church, and the Struggle to Thrive in America. She will be speaking on Monday, January 21st at the Dallas City Performance Hall as part of the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's MLK Symposium on the role of the African-American Church in the civil rights movement. If you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. I want to step back for just a minute, Carrie, because when you talk about the church and making decisions about how politically involved it would be and what the role ought to be and the position, a lot of the issues that we've been discussing about poverty apply to men and women and children. Why look specifically for this book at the issues of women?
Absolutely. I think one of the major reasons why I began to write about the Black church, because interestingly, this book did not begin by me wanting to interrogate the Black church. Mm-hmm. It began as an interrogation of the type of poverty that Black women experience. But what I increasingly came to realize is that in order to talk about the poverty of African-American women, it necessitated a turn to the Black church, because the Black church is primarily constituted in terms of membership by working class to poor Black women. Mm-hmm. And so to say anything really about the economic life chances of working class and poor Black women, as well as the conditions under which they're thriving as possible, that it was absolutely essential to turn to this historic institution that still is deeply influential upon the lives of African-American women, and a context out of which African-American women are doing what I would like to call their particular kinds of cultural work as well as spiritual work.
And there are Black churches that have set up faith-based initiatives to serve the needs of their poorer members in particular. Talk about what those initiatives can do and what the limitations are that still need to be sort of picked up and run with by the church itself, in your opinion.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you said that, because I think within the dialogue on faith-based initiatives, it's tended to be very polarized. Mm-hmm. And that is either, you know, it is wonderful, you know, in the ways that I'll describe here briefly in a moment. It's wonderful in terms of its ability to offer certain resources towards survival, right? So a young woman, African-American female, is able to come to a church and get basic resources such as food, such as, even I know a church that I was involved in, there was a mentoring component, for example, mm-hmm. For the children. So that's very huge, right?
Yeah.
Which I think could be understood as even child care. They were coming after school to be mentored and tutored. So on one side, it's great, but without any sort of critique of its limitations. And on the other side, there's been this, well, it is a violation of the separation of church and state, that whenever we're talking about government giving money to churches and then sort of specifying particular criteria under which they can operate with these initiatives, for example, you cannot proselytize or talk about the mission of the church or particular theological
right.
doctrines that you have, that this is problematic. And part of what I tried to do is, I don't want to say reconcile, that's probably too strong of a word, but to show the ways in which there is a sort of tension. So there's not a wholesale rejection of these faith-based initiatives that I hold, but there's not a wholesale acceptance that for many Black churches, it has provided funding to do things that many Black churches are already doing. Mm-hmm. They already have food pantries. They already are providing these sorts of mentoring and childcare opportunities that I just talked about. They're doing this kind of work. But on the other end, in a study that David Bositis did, a political scientist, where he researched and he found out that there is also a lot of suspicion that many Black churches, Black church leaders carry with faith-based initiatives, so that really the small percentage in the end that actually utilize the services of faith-based initiatives tended to be, I don't want to say affluent churches, but they came with a certain amount of resources that actually the very churches that needed the help the most in terms of perhaps had very few resources did not have, for example, the legal services in order to understand the documentation, in order to understand their sort of part in the legal process, that in the end, they were unable to really take advantage of these resources. So for me, there are possibilities with faith-based initiatives. But then one of the largest limitations that I get at is that it doesn't deal really substantively with sort of the ways in which poor Black women are continued to be labeled as morally responsible ultimately for the deprivation that they are a part of, that they are situated in, that actually faith-based initiatives can reinforce this very logic that I talk about. And to me, that was what was most problematic. It continues to be most problematic about these initiatives.
Is there messaging in Black from Black church pulpits that says, you know, if you're poor today, you should sort of just take this on as a burden and accept that suffering? Or what kind of discussions take place from within church services themselves about how to sort of understand and process the realities of living in poverty?
Wow, I think that's a great question. I think there are sort of a plethora mm-hmm. of responses. I think one is sort of equating poverty to a spiritual ailment, mm-hmm. That if you sort of get right with God, then you will not experience poverty. So, so of course, what you can see then is that to be poor is somehow to not be what God would want you to be, which has huge sort of.
So again, you're vilifying people.
That's right, yeah. Vilifying people, absolutely. And then, as I talk about in one chapter, in line with maybe that is also this idea that, and I talk about prosperity gospel, the idea that if one gives, right, if one just gives the tithe, if one just simply sort of gives to the church, that they will not find themselves in that sort of economic state, that they will not be poor, without really understanding, as I talk about the complex factors, right, again, that surround poverty. I give the example of, places around the world, for example, in Southeast Asia, where, and even in Africa, where clearly this logic begins to break down that one is in God's favor if one is wealthy. So therefore, if one is poor, obviously one is not in God's favor. Mm-hmm. And I think that these are a lot of the messages that are being circulated and are gaining currency. Now, I do want to say at the same time, there are pockets of churches that are challenging that type of message, calling it, naming it as oppressive, and offering sort of liberative understandings that are deeply rooted in liberation theology, in structural oppression, and in saying that, you know, it is about how we care for the least of these that is most important, and that one's economic status has nothing to do with whether one is in God's favor or not.
I want to talk about a term, Carrie, that comes up throughout the book, and that is womanist, which is different than the sort of modern understanding of the term feminist, but has a relationship. Can you explain the difference between the two?
Absolutely. The term sort of feminist, of course, really emerged in sort of the middle of the 20th century, right? And at that time, the beginning, whether you're talking about academically feminist discourses or the political movement, the feminist movement that emerged, is that sort of broadly, the feminist movement was a sort of white middle class feminist was in a white middle class feminist voice. And so you had poor white women, I think a lot of times, that were excluded from how we begin to talk about what it means to be feminist, what it means to take up women's issues. But then also African-American women found themselves excluded from how we talked about women's realities. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, during the 70s and the 80s, the talk about women needing to be seen as having value in the workforce, it just wasn't about seeing women as some as an individual that is essentially domesticated, right? That is precluded to the home. And so this was sort of the experience of many white middle class women, was to really make this argument that they could be in the workplace and in sort of social organization the same way as men. Well, part of the issue with that is that black women have been working for decades, right? Mm-hmm. That actually, when we talk about slavery, we're talking about the production and the reproduction of African-American women. So that how the feminist movement, how feminist discourses were talking about women's realities did not resonate and excluded the lived realities of women of color. Now, womanist sort of emerged really through Alice Walker, mm-hmm. interestingly.
The novelist.
Yeah, the novelist. The Color Purple is the novel that we all know the best that was made into the movie by Steven Spielberg. But essentially, the idea or the term womanist was to take up the lived experiences of black women, particularly in America, as Alice Walker's and then others, of course, would develop it. And to really try to discuss not only the lived realities, but also the ways in which black women then, in light of the lived realities they experience of oppression, as well as flourishing, the ways in which they could experience liberation and quality of life. And so this is really important, because for womanism, it really was about how do we begin to speak more inclusively about a group that tends to be rendered invisible and inaudible, and that was black women.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Amanda in Fort Worth, who wants to know if you have ever read The Woman's Bible by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and if so, did you find it relevant to your studies?
Oh, wow. Absolutely. I think what I love about Elizabeth Cady Stanton is her willingness in her written work and in that particular book that that the email person sent to challenge sort of traditional categories and notions of the divine, for example. I mean, part of what she was doing is she was sort of exploding the patriarchal categories of how we understand God. For example, we call God He. Primarily, mm-hmm. And the ways in which, in sort of doing that, what is perhaps lost in our discussion of how we understand God in the world around us, right? And the ways in which, as well, in sort of patriarchal notions of the divine, how that can actually lead to women's oppression, and so sort of how I wouldn't say that I directly sort of draw upon, right, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, but I think what I try to do in the spirit of Elizabeth Cady Stanton is then to go and begin to challenge very reified sort of concepts that we hold on to, that we take for granted, such as the American dream. That, well, of course, we can all achieve the American dream. The way it is almost not just ritualized in this nation in terms of the slogan, you know, just sort of what we say that rolls off of our lips, but also the ways in which it's reified as given, like natural, like the air we breathe, that it cannot be questioned. And I question it, and I say, well, actually, this particular idea of the American dream really begins to break down in the presence of the lived economic experiences of not only poor black women, but more broadly of poor people across racial categories, which is why King in the 1960s begins to think about, alongside Marian Wright Edelman, the Poor People's Campaign movement, and why we are even now returning to that, not now in the form of Occupy Wall Street, is because it is about challenging these taken for granted categories that can produce so much symbolic violence in the process.
How patriarchal is the black church in America?
Wow. Well, it's a really great question. Part of at least what I try to get at in the book is that Many African-American women have experienced the black church as extremely patriarchal. Maybe I should say black churches to keep in line with how I've been arguing that the black church is not monolithic.
Right.
That certainly, again, I want to lift up, there are pockets, there are black churches that take the question of gender equality and egalitarianism seriously. But, you know, I do kind of sit back and think to myself when I see, you know, many denominations, African-American denominations, that still will not ordain women as clergy. For example, the Church of God in Christ, which I talk about in the book, it was at one point the fastest growing African-American denomination, and it actually still is the fastest growing Pentecostal denomination, period, worldwide. And so then when you turn to Kojic and you see that this particular denomination does not ordain women, that this becomes deeply problematic about how we think about women in the life of the black church in terms of leadership and the like, that women still experience black women, black church spaces as deeply sexist and patriarchal. And then finally, I'd be remiss if I didn't note this, that we talk about a lot of clergy scandal, right? Abuse mm-hmm. and misconduct, black male clergy leaders. We could talk about, remember Eddie Long, the scandal I think that took place in 2010, mm-hmm. and the young men that came forward to talk about what had transpired. Now, the media just converged on this issue, right? It was talked about and certainly needed to be talked about. What was dismissed or really ignored, some people didn't even know this, is that there were also similar complaints that were issued forth by women who came forth, which was, literally, it was inaudible. I mean, even to this day, there are some people that don't even know that there were women that had made complaints against Eddie Long. And so, and this is just one example, right, that I'm giving of the ways in which black women's bodies and black women's voices often are seen as not counting and are not heard in the way that they need to be.
So in other words, in the coverage of that, the sexual exploitation of black women was not considered as serious
That's
a crime.
Right. That's
as,
right.
That of young men.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it continues to be an issue. And I mean, so whether it's the ordination of women or sort of how black women's bodies and voices and vocations, for that matter, are treated in black church spaces. Because, again, to keep in mind that black women constitute, I think it's like over 75% of black church membership here in America. But again, these churches are still black male led and dominated.
So where are all the men within the congregations supporting the women at their sides, if not in their families, that their neighbors and their coworkers and friends?
Sure. You know, I think that particular question is part of the answer is tied into really Michelle Alexander's book that came out in 2010, The New Jim Crow. And I sort of talk about
the
it
new
in my
Jane
terms,
Crow.
Right, as the new Jane Crow, in which sort of briefly she talks about the disproportionate number of black men in prisons across this nation. But that a part of it has, a large part of it, has to do with sort of inequitable and unjust treatment that these young, let's keep in mind, these are 16-year-olds, many of them, mm-hmm. first-time nonviolent offenders are getting these huge sentence times. And when they come out, they're disenfranchised in terms of employment, in terms of the vote, in terms of a wide variety of things over, for example, when they were 16, selling drugs. And so, and part of what she talks about is that so many of our young African-American men are locked in this prison pipeline, a scenario. So that then when we talk about where are the black men within the church, that part of this has to do with the problem of mass incarceration and the problem of the prison industrial complex.
Carrie Day is with us. Her book is Unfinished Business. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Carrie Day, Assistant Professor of Theological and Social Ethics and Director of Black Church Studies at Bright Divinity School. Her new book is called Unfinished Business, Black Women, the Black Church, and the Struggle to Thrive in America. You can hear her speak on Monday, January 21st at the Dallas City Performance Hall when the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture holds its MLK Symposium. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. We have Rhonda on the line now in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi. Hi. Thank you so much.
Sure.
I am calling because I am a black woman, 55 years old. I don't usually tell people how old I am, but I wanted to put it into context, meaning that, you know, I've had some experience with the civil rights movement, the latter part of it. I was educated at a historically black college, grew up Catholic for a little bit, but also now I'm a member of a black church here and have been for over 20 years. And one of the things that continues to perplex me as a black woman in the context of the church in terms of, you know, the why of the poverty for black women, if that's what you're focusing on, is the emphasis or lack of emphasis on education and also the deterioration of the continued deterioration of the family to the extent of many unwed mothers, you know, babies being born out of wedlock. And I just know, again, from my experience, longtime member of a church, we get a lot of preaching and teaching from the pulpit perspective, but the reality of where we're living, you know, as black women, as black families, perhaps is not being addressed as thoroughly as it possibly could. And I'm just wondering if you're, if the author there and the professor there has any insights into, you know, what's being done on the larger scale, you know, beyond my myopic view here in the Dallas, Texas area.
Rhonda, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and let me just start here, Rhonda. I don't think that your view is myopic at all. I think that you bring up a very good point. And part of what I hear Rhonda talking about are some of the cultural issues, the kind of cultural fallout, right, that oftentimes will happen when groups of people feel themselves to experience real serious, structurally at least speaking, economic impediments. And so what she's getting at concerning, for example, unwed pregnancies. Now, one great thing, which is interesting, which is not talked about a lot, is that unwed pregnancy, generally speaking, has gone down over the last decade, although African-American women between the ages of 18 all the way up to 21 is still a disproportionate number, right? We know that unwed pregnancies in real numbers is not particularly African-American. They don't have the majority, but still is disproportionate. And it certainly affects the African-American community. And that's what I hear Rhonda saying, is that we're talking right now about these sort of structural issues, but how do we begin to seriously and substantively address these other sort of issues that that really hinder, right, the condition of African-American women's lives, poor African-American women's lives? And one of the things that she brought up concerning education is really important. Now, in the book, I talk about welfare policy, and this directly addresses at least part of Rhonda's question. I talk about welfare policy, and under the 1996 Welfare Reform Act, which was passed under Clinton, it was, of course, the policy where women had a certain number of times they were on welfare. It was anywhere from 5 to 7 years to transition from welfare to work. Part of the issues, though, that emerged that that many scholars begin to document is that when these women were transitioning, many of them, for example, wanted to further their education. They wanted to take up classes, but were directed to corporations and businesses that, for example, did not pay a living wage. They paid minimum wage. And what was found out later, I'm trying to remember the actual state that I talk about. In one particular state, there were actual contracts between the state government and actual corporations and businesses that literally predetermined where these women would go in terms of work. In other words, that they really didn't even have an opportunity to choose.
So there's no mobility.
Right, no mobility. They had no opportunity to actually choose. Even the idea of choice was an illusion in terms of whether they could further their educational skills in order to enter some sort of service occupation versus doing a minimum wage job. So that right here again is sort of this particular issue in that, of course, many of these women that find themselves in these particular situation feel a lack of cultural confidence in the system, right? That they don't feel valued. They don't feel worthy. They feel trapped. And so I think it's really important to hold that intention with what Rhonda is bringing up. And that is, alongside the structural issues, how do we begin to at least culturally deal with some of the issues that we're experiencing? And I think a lot of that does have to do with institutional leaders, those in the Black church. But again, this goes back to what I was saying earlier. A part of any solution, long-term solution, has to do with how, again, women are even treated and conceptualized within those spaces, right? That if it's still primarily in a lot of spaces sexist and patriarchal, that this deeply inhibits, right, the actual messages and practices, most importantly, that are needed for African-American women to feel a sense of belonging and worth.
So when you talk about, for example, the obligation or the responsibility, if not obligation, of the Black church to educate women about social justice and economic justice issues and ways that they can participate fully as citizens of a democracy, can you define for those of us who have lived our lives outside of the Black church how politics in the Black church come together? Because I think there's maybe a misconception, and I may be speaking out of turn here. I think a lot of people outside the Black church assume that what your pastor says is who you vote for, and that's how politics works within the Black church. And can you explain the kind of discussions that happen and the give and take and the back and forth when politics are discussed specifically?
Absolutely. Foremost would certainly depend upon which African-American denomination that mm-hmm. you would be talking about. For example, I can say that within the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, it seems to me within their history that how they've articulated the relationship between religion and politics has been much more liberative and egalitarian. In terms of really providing spaces for talk back, for example, within the community, between the community and the pastor, which, for example, would be different than, let's say, in a Pentecostal mm-hmm. church where most of the power is concentrated in the pastor.
So there
himself.
Is a specific recommendation in those cases.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Where because there is much more of a concentration of power, I think that there is a tendency for church members in a lot of ways to reify that particular Black male pastor as speaking the words of God, so that when it comes to questions of politics or decisions that need to be made, that there is a tendency to privilege what is coming from the pulpit, essentially. And not that that's not going on in just churches across the board, right?
Right.
But that there is a way in certain other denominations, such as the AME Church, I would argue that there's been this much more rich, and even Baptists, some Baptist denominations, there's been this much more rich understanding of what it means to have systems of accountability, talk back between members in the pulpit, as well as this rich history of social justice. And I think that that's part of what I'm getting at in my book, is the ways in which, you know, the question of how should we be agents of social transformation in our communities and in larger society, that I think these particular denominations like AME and Baptist have taken up historically.
To the extent that some of that focus on social justice has fallen away, what happened? Why did this cease to be a primary focus?
Sure. And let me just again note here that, I mean, part of what I argue in the book is that, you know, really, in terms of the majority, again, of Black churches, in terms of the Black church being identified as sort of the institution or the agent of social justice, that needs to be challenged. Mm-hmm. Because in the history of the memory of the Black church, it was always the daring, courageous few.
Right.
So I want to be, yeah.
So is that enough even in the present time for there to be the daring, courageous few?
And that's what I hope, at least one of the implications, the implications of the book that people will take away, is that part of, at least for me, the message that I'm trying to convey is that it was always, you know, the minority of churches that were at the forefront of social transformation. And that so that maybe when we talk about the Black church and the future of the Black church and whether it can be efficacy in the role, that maybe it's not about how we get Black churches en masse to do a particular kind of thing, whether that's politically or economically. But what are the ways in which we are cultivating, educating, and supporting those Black churches that really have decided, at least in their minds, that they're going to do the type of prophetic work that is needed. Now, that's not to negate, again, that there is a call upon more Black churches to become involved. And we saw that at the, you know, with the passage of the civil rights legislation, where everyone got behind it then, mm-hmm. right?
When it seems sure to pass and it's clear you want to be on the right side of history.
Exactly. You know, so people get behind it. They got behind it eventually, all Black, you know, most Black churches. But I think it is about how we allow those churches that are either doing this work or want to do this work, but need that type of education and cultivation and support to make that possible. But it is about the minority, the cadre of the courageous and daring few that I am trying to communicate in this book, not only for sort of the race-based movements that happened during the civil rights era, but also as I talk about the unfinished business, the last crusade of the civil rights movement, which was the Poor People's Campaign movement, the movement for economic justice.
Are young women turning to the church in the same numbers and with the same amount of passion that their mothers and grandmothers did?
It's a great question. And, you know, as we were both talking on break, that the Black church in general has followed the same pattern as churches here in America. And that has been a sort of decline, right? In a lot of ways, our churches, it's not to use a word that's really not a word, are oldening, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think in a lot of ways, I would say in some ways, no. For example, I think part of the reason why is because moving into the 21st century, there are more African-American institutions that are owned by African-Americans, mm-hmm. you know, such as banks, such as professional organizations and the like, so that the Black church is no longer the sole central, right, context out of which Black folk can come together and organize and galvanize and the like. So I think that's the first thing, sort of a practical reason.
Yeah.
And I think the other reason is because, at least among our youth today, like Black women, there are other institutions that are emerging that they are finding a better sense of belonging, like, for example, hip-hop. Hip-hop has been seen as a passing fad. Well, it's interesting because hip-hop culture more broadly, even hip-hop music, you know, it is a global phenomenon now. It is not only consumed mostly by white men, but, I mean, right now, one nation that consumes it the most is China, for example. And then that hip-hop is not only music, but it's also a culture. It is an institution that many young African-American women and men are turning to for meaning, for interpretation of their realities and the like. So I think it is also the way in which the Black church negotiates this new sort of emerging scene in which we're having a proliferation of new African-American institutions that have the attention of Black youth.
And I guess there's always that question as to whether, you know, you trade some relevancy for the soundness of the message. I think there's some positive messages in hip hop, and there are some that I think most of us responsible adults would say not what we want our young people emulating.
Absolutely. And I love how Michael Eric Dyson says, you know, we need to teach our young people to be hip hop intellectuals. You know, that is
to read it and interpret it.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right. That is really understand the death dealing and dangerous, absolutely destructive aspects of hip hop, but also understand that it comes out of this long tradition of protest music in the tradition of jazz and blues, that its origins, you know, in the late 20th century began in the Bronx, New York, DJing graffiti as well as the music, the rap. And it was for ex-gang offenders who were being rehabilitated. And they would do stuff, you know, for the civil rights movement, host concerts to raise funds and for apartheid in South Africa. These are the rich origins, right, of hip hop. And it's about how do you get young people to think beyond the beat in order to return to that? And I think think that going back even to Rhonda's question, what do we do in terms of, you know, this other aspect of poor young black women? And even if there are structural issues, these other issues that are really culturally significant, right, that affect their life. And that is, how, I think part of the answer is then how do we begin to negotiate as a black church becoming relevant to these new realities?
Carrie Day is Assistant Professor of Theological and Social Ethics and Director of Black Church Studies at Bright Divinity School. Her book is called Unfinished Business, Black Women, the Black Church, and the Struggle to Thrive in America. She'll be speaking on Monday, January 21st at the Dallas City Performance Hall to the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture's MLK Symposium on the role of the African-American church in the civil rights movement. Carrie, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been wonderful.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Lindsay Connect on the phones. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. And the podcast is prepared by Christine McConnell. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.